Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist and author Rahul Mahajan, who assesses the likelihood that the Bush administration will bow to public pressure to change direction in their failed Iraq war policy. Laura Carlson of the International Relations Center Americas Program, who examines the continuing victories of left and center-left political parties across Latin America. And Carmen Barroso of the International Planned Parenthood Federation, who discusses the positive and negative trends for women's access to abortion throughout Central and South America. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
While major oil giants like Royal Dutch Shell and British Petroleum have expressed a new concern over global warming, they are maneuvering to profit from it. According to the American Prospect magazine, ConocoPhillips, BP, and other major oil companies are looking under the warming Arctic waters for new reserves of crude oil and natural gas. The U.S. Geological Survey estimates that a quarter of all untapped oil and gas fields lie under the Arctic ice. Reserves off the coast of Alaska hold an estimated 25 billion barrels of crude oil, which at the current market price is worth $1.5 trillion. Other profitable oil fields lay under the Arctic waters of Denmark, Canada, Russia, and Greenland. Companies and drillers like Devon Energy are not waiting for politicians to debate global warming. They're now actively buying up oil leases in environmentally fragile regions of the Arctic. In recent months, oil companies have bought up $400 million in oil leases on the Beaufort Sea in Canada, with plans to build that country's biggest pipeline to provide oil to a thirsty public. Melting ice could also open up new commercial shipping lanes in the Northwest Passage of northern Canada. Talk of new offshore energy development in the Arctic makes environmentalists and native peoples nervous. A major oil spill in open Arctic water could severely damage the ecosystem and harm whales, the lifeblood of the Inuit culture. The radiation poisoning of ex-KGB officer Alexander Litvinenko in London on November 1st has raised disturbing questions about the state of Russia under President Vladimir Putin. From his deathbed, the former spy-turned-Russian dissident blamed Putin for his poisoning by the radioactive material polonium-210. Putin and his allies have denied any wrongdoing, but British investigators are going to Moscow to question witnesses in a criminal inquiry. Experts say a minuscule amount of polonium-210, less than would fit on the head of a pin, is all it would take to fatally poison someone. The London Observer suggests the toxic material must have been supplied by state-sponsored scientists working in Russian nuclear laboratories or reprocessing centers. Over the last 15 years, there have been ongoing concerns about smuggling from Russia's nuclear labs. In 1993, the Bulletin of American Scientists reported 10 kilograms of polonium-210 missing from a major Russian research complex. More recently, the United Nations-based International Atomic Energy Agency has found Iran has conducted experiments with polonium-210, possibly with material from Russia. Friends of Litvinenko say a major conspiracy was orchestrated against the former KGB agent. Former Russian spy Yuri Shvets, who was questioned by the FBI and Scotland Yard in the case, told the Associated Press, "We have a case of international terrorism on our hands." A possible motive for his murder was Litvinenko's interest in the killing of journalist Anna Politkovskaya, who was shot in her apartment building in Moscow. At his fatal meeting on November 1st, the ex-KGB agent discussed a lead in the journalist's murder, which mentioned a Russian hit list that had Litvinenko's name on it. Many new immigrants who traveled to New Orleans for post-Katrina work have gotten cheated on wages. These undocumented Latino immigrants speak little English and usually accept cash for work. They complain that subcontractors of government-funded cleanup projects often refuse to pay them. Mexican immigrant Leonel Santos didn't get paid for 3 months by LJC Defense Contractors, which had a contract from the Army Corps of Engineers to place blue tarps over hurricane-damaged homes. Santos worked for 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, and slept in a park at night. Recently, several Mexican workers filed a complaint with the U.S. Department of Labor seeking $1,600 per worker in back wages. New Orleans attorney Luz Molina, who has filed cases on behalf of immigrants, told the Los Angeles Times, "I would describe this as the new Wild West of labor law, where lawlessness is absolutely tolerated." In another case, the National Immigration Law Center filed suit against Decatur Hotels on behalf of 82 guest workers recruited from Latin America and the Caribbean. The workers charged that the hotel chain reneged on work hours they were promised. The Southern Poverty Law Center has interviewed 500 immigrants in New Orleans who have had problems getting paid from contractors of all kinds. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
American voters went to the polls on November 7th and sent a strong message about their anger over the increasingly bloody Iraq war. Near-record disapproval of President Bush's leadership on the war and domestic policy cost the Republicans control of the House and Senate, where they had, since 2001, acted essentially as a rubber stamp for the White House. With the post-election resignation of Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and a set of recommendations for change from the Iraq Study Group led by James Baker and Lee Hamilton, it appears that the president's stay-the-course policy in Iraq may soon be modified. But recent statements from President Bush belie the conventional wisdom that change is coming. On November 30th, Bush rejected the idea that policy prescriptions from the Iraq Study Group would pave the way for a graceful U.S. exit out of Iraq. With the Democrats taking charge of Congress in January, questions about how far the party will go to press for a withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq by wielding the legislature's power of the purse are still largely unanswered. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with journalist and author Rahul Mahajan, who looks at the worsening civil war conditions in Iraq and the public pressure building on the administration for a rapid end to America's occupation there.
Some of the things that seemed most, realistic about what the study group was concluding have probably been taken out because of the strong feeling on the part of Republicans in the study group that they should defer to the president. I see that there is a real change in the political climate. The ice is kind of breaking on the question of withdrawal or of basically accepting that the United States is not going to win in Iraq. I mean, even Chuck Hagel wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post saying precisely that, that victory in Iraq is essentially impossible. So there is a changed political climate, but there is a very, very unchanged White House. And I think that for the time being, at least, there's not sufficient pressure to push them to really significantly alter their strategy in Iraq.
Rahul, I just wanted to get your view. What do you see happening in Iraq right now, and is there any chance that the U.S. can do anything else but leave Iraq? Given the exponential rate of increase in the violence there day to day, the ethnic violence, the rise of the insurgents that are attacking the United States forces, the withdrawal of U.S. allies, what is happening there, and what do you think the U.S. can do about it, if anything?
What has happened, I guess, is, I mean, there's a whole bunch of things that are sort of tangled up together. One is that the sectarian conflict has completely sort of permeated down to the individual level, to the level where individual citizens who have no particular connection to any sort of power considerations are regularly singled out and killed on the basis of their sectarian identity, where people who don't even necessarily want to get into the sectarian polarization are drawn into it because they see sectarian militias as the of their own sect, of course, as the only possible source of security they have. I mean, the incredibly open secret is that U.S. troops, on with rare exceptions, are not providing security. The one thing they may be doing is that it's true that with U.S. troops in the country that the various feuding forces can't engage in large-scale military maneuvers, but they are not providing security against the day-to-day dirty war-type violence that is going on. The only groups that are providing any security for individuals are those very same sectarian groups that are killing individuals of the other sect. And so the polarization and the fractionization, the fragmentation, has reached such a point that it's hard to imagine how to patch Humpty Dumpty together again. I mean, it's a situation that is almost irremediable whether the United States stays or goes. That said, I think it's also clear that the presence of the United States is making things worse, if only because the United States is still contributing at least roughly 25% of the total fatality.
after the elections on November 7th, where the Democrats took control of the House and Senate, many people are wondering what the Democrats will bring to the table in terms of influencing the direction of U.S. policy in Iraq. In the House particularly, they do have control over budgets and could hold up additional monies for the war in Iraq if they chose to do so. Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, has basically said that won't occur. But where do you see the Democrats going here with Iraq policy? Do they have any ability to control the outcome of events here?
If I were to issue a call to action, which of course I would never do on the air, I think that it's quite important, in fact, to lobby intensely. The next supplemental spending bill comes up, which is going to be a particularly large one. It presents an important point of application for an anti-war movement that has been having a great deal of difficulty figuring out how to organize itself and what kinds of tactics might possibly make a difference. But I agree with Nancy Pelosi. There is absolutely no way in hell that any but a few fringe Democrats are going to oppose appropriations for continuing the war. They don't have that level of political courage. And for many of them, I mean, they don't really even seem to have any clear assessment of what's going on, what goals are being served by being in Iraq, what goals would be imperiled if they left, what other goals would be imperiled if they stay. I mean, it's phenomenal to see a discussion about possible strategies by all kinds of realist types and pundits and politicians, none of whom want to talk seriously about the interest that the United States has at stake here. They all talk nonsense about, are we trying to create a stable democratic Iraq because we love democracy? Should we just have a stable Iraq because we love stability? Until there is serious talk about that, you know, minor permutations of this kind of exit strategy or that kind are really meaningless, and when, you know, when it comes to the crunch, will actually be completely nugatory because they will not be based on, again, an understanding of what's at stake.
That was Rahul Mahajan, author of the book Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, published by Seven Stories Press. Read Mahajan's commentaries online at www.empirenotes.org. Over the past 5 weeks, candidates of left and center-left political parties have won a string of presidential elections in Brazil, Nicaragua, Ecuador, and Venezuela. The year began with a stunning electoral triumph of Evo Morales, an Indian activist and advocate for the poor in Bolivia, and ended with the re-election of President Hugo Chavez to another six-year term in oil-rich Venezuela. These leaders join incumbent progressive heads of state in Argentina and Uruguay. Powerful left parties are thriving in many other Latin American nations, including Mexico, where the ongoing dispute over a July presidential election has mobilized hundreds of thousands to protest what many believe to be a tainted vote count. There, Andrés Manuel López Obrador of the Party of Democratic Revolution and his supporters have carried out a campaign of civil disobedience to underscore their contention that the election was stolen. During what some observers describe as Latin America's pink tide revolution, the Bush administration has been unable to exert much influence to reverse the progressive trend. The White House effort to expand the North American Free Trade Agreement to the entire hemisphere in the free trade area of the Americas Treaty has failed. And while President Bush unsuccessfully attempted to blackmail voters in Nicaragua to prevent the election of one-time Cold War foe Daniel Ortega, Washington and Paris together succeeded in ousting Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide in 2004. An earlier Bush administration effort to overthrow the elected government of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela in 2002 was stopped by an outpouring of popular support for Chavez. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Laura Carlson, director of the International Relations Center's Americas program. Reached in Mexico City, Carlson examines the economic conditions that have empowered left parties across the hemisphere and the challenges ahead for progressive governments looking to develop a set of alternative development policies outside the control of Washington's free market orthodoxy.
So although each case in each country merits its own examination and even the politics of these people in office and even before office are a mixed bag in many ways, it's certainly true that what we're seeing is a strong statement from the grassroots that we've had enough. they're asking for demands that have to do with an end to the huge level of inequality that exists in these countries. And this inequality is due mostly to neoliberal policies and what's known down here as the Washington Consensus of the early 90s. They're policies that privatize state goods, that made the state get out of redistribution of wealth and other types of social programs, and that left the poor very vulnerable and in many cases increased the number of poor while creating these small economic oligarchies that are tied into the international economy and that are very powerful and very, very wealthy. That was a situation that just became unsustainable in many countries here in Latin America, and that's the message that we're getting out of these elections.
Has the election of these left and center-left heads of state around Latin America, have they made any difference in terms of the quality of life for many people who suffered under the free market policies pushed by Washington over many years?
It's a little soon to tell in many cases, but in some cases we can definitely say that they have. In Brazil, there's been a decrease in poverty due to these social programs like what they call the family dispensa, which is a payment that goes out to families, and some other projects that have to do with fomenting small business and things like that. So they're beginning to statistically see a decrease in certain types of poverty. In Argentina, of course, it was when the government that at first wasn't even considered very leftist, but began to take an increasingly radical stance in terms of its position to the International Monetary Fund and the international economy. And, of course, it was many of those positions that actually threw the orthodoxy of neoliberal politics out the window that were managed to save Argentina from an extremely severe crisis at the beginning of in 2001, 2002. So in that sense, they certainly have been positive. And then the other thing that we see as a real sign of hope is that by having these governments, they're able to operate as a way of kind of stopping this hegemony of the United States that's been a very strong tendency under the Bush government especially, in which on the one hand the United States is trying to impose free trade agreements that contain clauses and measures that are designed to benefit U.S.-based transnational corporations and that we know have many ill effects on developing countries. So they've been able to hold that off. We saw that happen with the free trade agreement that was going to be imposed on the Americas as a whole, the FTAA, which was blocked by Brazil and Argentina, basically. And we've seen it in other countries that have been able to say, no, we don't want this kind of an agreement. That's the one side. And on the other side, there's a new possibility for these countries to get together and form their own kinds of organizations that are able to break out of that pattern of being the backyard of the United States, which is a classic term, and it has a lot, unfortunately, that's true about it. But by getting together, they're able to have more power to leverage in dealing with the United States, both in terms of geopolitical hegemony and in terms of some of the trade policies.
I know Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, who was just reelected, he himself has posited a particular alternative to the FTAA, the Free Trade Area of the Americas Treaty, rejected, as you said, throughout Latin America. So what are the possibilities for this new bloc, new economic bloc?
Right now, Latin America is being seen as the region that is perhaps advancing the most rapidly in creating alternatives and at least conceiving of alternatives to this free trade train that was seemed to be almost inevitable at a time until it was stopped in the World Trade Organization and then later stopped in the free trade area of the Americas, and now it will probably be slowing down in U.S. Congress as well. So Latin America has taken a lead here. It's rebuilding the Mercosur, which is the southern common market, and it has a lot of big decisions to make in that process. Because it could just turn out that you recreate basically the same model on a regional level. But there are quite a few people, both in civil society and even in some of these governments that we talked about, the new center-left governments, that want something different. They're looking at ways in which they can be more cooperative and they can make their economies complementary instead of competing in the same commodities on an international market. They're looking at ways in which they can integrate markets and production in a more environmentally friendly way and socially friendly way than strictly looking at advantages on the international market. All these things are on the table right now, and it's not really clear where it's going to go, but it's a time of tremendous hope in that sense and tremendous possibilities that didn't exist even just a few years ago.
That was Laura Carlson, director of the International Relations Center's Americas program in Mexico City. Contact the center by calling area code 505-388-0208 or visit their website at americas.irc-online.org. Nicaragua made news recently, not only for re-electing Sandinista party leader Daniel Ortega president, but also for passage of an October law that criminalizes all abortions, even to save the life of the mother. The law is now being challenged in court, but it's already being enforced and has caused the death of at least one woman thus far. Throughout Latin America and the Caribbean, with the exception of Cuba, Puerto Rico, Guyana, and Barbados, abortions are criminalized to one degree or another. So, as women in the U.S. fight a rearguard action to maintain the right to abortion, their sisters to the south are fighting more extreme restrictions. The heaviest burden falls on poor women, as those with the means can usually secure safe abortions, even if they are legal. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Carmen Barroso, director of the International Planned Parenthood Federation's Western Hemisphere region. She talks about both positive and negative trends, starting with the recent passage of Nicaragua's harsh new abortion law.
It is the most egregious violation of women's rights because in Nicaragua, the maternal death rate is among the highest in the region, and abortion, unsafe abortions are responsible for 16% of all maternal deaths. It's a high proportion because it's totally preventable. You know, if you provide women with safe abortions, it would be 0%. So criminalize abortion in Nicaragua will increase maternal mortality and worsen the status of women's health. And it's outrageous that in such a poor country where there are so many problems, the grip of the Catholic Church and the evangelicals together bring this vote that is counter the trend in other countries where the process is exactly in the opposite direction of increasing recognition of women's rights.
In what other countries is there a complete ban or almost a complete ban on abortion?
The role of shame includes Nicaragua now and El Salvador and Chile.
You know, that's very interesting. With the new president of Chile, Michelle Bachelet, being both a woman and a pediatrician, has she said anything about trying to relax the ban?
Well, she is under attack for many other reasons, so she is being cautious for the time being. I'm sure she is personally in favor, but politically it's not the best moment for her to move in that direction.
So, Carmen Barroso, tell us about other changes in this region where there have been so many political changes recently.
Legally, there were three major positive changes. One that had received the most publicity was the case of Colombia, which used to be a country where abortion was banned in all cases, too. The court found that prohibition was against women's rights and it violated the nation's constitution. So now abortion in Colombia is permitted when a pregnancy threatens a woman's life or health, and in case of rape, incest, and fetal impairment. In addition to Colombia, there are two other cases in Mexico and in Peru. Well, Mexico, first of all, there was some liberalization of the laws in the capital, in the Mexico City district. So the laws in Mexico City now allow abortion for several reasons, including economic reasons. In the case of Peru, a case was brought before the United Nations Commission on Human Rights. And it was a case of a 17-year-old Peruvian woman who had been violated, and the health officials denied her a therapeutic abortion, although her fetus carried a fatal abnormality. The fetus would die immediately after birth anyway, but abortion was not permitted for her, and the case was brought in this International Commission on Human Rights, and they ruled for the rights of the women.
What about abortion rights in the most populous country in Latin America, Brazil?
Brazil is an interesting case because last year the Minister of Women's Affairs carried out a very broad consultation all over the country about the priorities that women had in the, for her as a government official to forward women's rights. And abortion liberalization or legalization of abortion in a larger number of cases came out as a very important priority. So she sponsored the formation of a multi-sectorial, multi-party committee that drafted a new law for liberalization of abortion. This law, unfortunately, was stalled because of the pressure of the church with the president. And so it is now discussed with less political clout than it had initially.
How does International Planned Parenthood operate in all these different countries?
In each country, we have a member association, and this is usually a very large provider of family planning services, of AIDS prevention services, of sex education. Most of them do not provide abortion because the cases where abortion is legally permitted are very few, like rape and so on. Some of them are starting to provide abortions in those legal cases for women who need them and so on. But many of our associations do not provide abortions because they don't feel they have the conditions to do that.
That was Carmen Barroso of the International Planned Parenthood Federation. Contact the Federation's New York office at area code 212-214-0287 or visit their website at www.ippfwhr.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.